Springs Board of Taxes is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. Due to settlements, the court has only one matter on its oral submission docket this morning. It is Commonwealth Lloyds Insurance Company and the United States Fire Insurance Company versus Cullen Frost Bank of Dallas, N.A., from Dallas County. The court has allotted 25 minutes for each side to present oral argument in this cause. The petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal argument by so advising the marshal. We will record these arguments. If you desire to listen to a tape, you may make application with our clerk. The court is ready to hear arguments from petitioners, Commonwealth Lloyds, and United States Fire.
May it please the court, Mr. Kevin Cook, this is argument for petitioners, reserving 7 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, as the marshals indicated, my name is Kevin Cook, and I represent petitioners, Commonwealth Lloyds, and U.S. Fire. The issue in this case is the insurer's duty to defend Cullen Frost against allegations which have been brought against them by a group known as the Tompkins Plaintiffs. The Tompkins plaintiffs filed suit against Cullen Frost in September 1987. These individuals were purchasers of condominiums from Cullen Frost in 1984-1985. They alleged that an inspection, which was performed in the spring of 1986, revealed that there were numerous structural defects in the property. These included fire hazards, warped doors and windows, rotted woodwork, roof leaks, and elevators which were out of service. Based on this inspection, the Tompkins plaintiffs alleged that because Cullen Frost failed to correct them, these structural defects, which were discovered in spring of 1986, the plaintiffs were continually exposed to dangerous and harmful conditions which resulted in their loss and use of and enjoyment of the property. The Tompkins plaintiffs also alleged that Cullen Frost was made aware of these problems and failed to correct them. These two allegations demonstrate that whatever continued loss of use and enjoyment allegations there are in this petition are as a result of the defects that were discovered in the spring of 1986. These allegations also demonstrate that contrary to their claim, Cullen Frost was made aware of these problems. Based on these allegations, the Tompkins plaintiffs allege a misrepresentation and deceptive trade practice allegation against Cullen Frost, and also a negligence allegation that Cullen Frost was negligent during the construction of project in their allocation and monitoring of the construction funds, which resulted in the structural defects that were discovered in the spring of 1986. The two insurers, which are the petitioners in this case, issued a total of 5 policies. And if I may, I'd like to use this chart that demonstrates the timing of the policies. I do need to tell the court that this is the respondent's chart. I didn't prepare. There's one thing on here that I don't think is consistent with the underlying allegations. There were 3 policies issued by Commonwealth Lloyds. The first was a 3-year policy from February 1983 to February 1986. The second was 6 months from February 1986 to November 1986. The third was a 1-year policy November 86 to November 87. At that point in time, U.S. Fire became the insurance company and issued 2 1-year policies. November 87 to November 1988, and November 1988 to November 1989. Within the realm of these 5 policies, the spring of 1986 is when the inspection was performed that discovered the defects. Although this chart says it was a plaintiff's inspection, the underlying complaint made by the Tompkins plaintiffs indicated that it was Cullen Frost who had the inspection, as well as Cullen Frost was made aware of the defects. Suit was filed in September 1987 before either of the 2 U.S. Fire policies ever came into effect.
Court of Appeals held that because there was property damage which was taking place throughout this entire period of time, all five of these policies potentially have application. Even the three policies which came into effect after the inspection which discovered the defects upon which suit was brought, and even the two policies which came into effect after the inspection and after the lawsuit was filed. The Court of Appeals essentially reached this result by, one, merging the concept of property damage and occurrence into one, and determining essentially that whenever there was property damage, there was an occurrence. And second, by ruling that it didn't violate public policy to allow the three policies that came into effect after the damage was discovered to potentially apply to the loss.
Setting aside the U.S. fire policies for now, for purposes of my question, the loss in progress rule, why isn't there a duty to defend, at least under the allegations in the second amended petition, if we apply Texas law that says that we don't look beyond the pleadings to determine the duty to defend as opposed to the duty to indemnify?
Your Honor, the policies require there to be an occurrence before the company has any obligation to pay or obligation to defend. The insurance agreement requires that the sums for bodily injury property damage be caused by an occurrence. Occurrence is defined as an accident which results in bodily injury or property damage. Essentially, what these definitions show you is that the occurrence, which is the accident, is separate from the property damage. The cases that interpret these policies determine there's a two-step process to determine when the occurrence, or what was the occurrence that obligates the company to pay and defend. The two-step process is the first to determine what the occurrence was, and then second to determine when it occurred.
How is the insured supposed to determine that when they've been sued and they're trying to get, presumably, a defense by their liability insurance carrier? Or would you impose upon the insured the obligation to decide finally when this occurrence happened?
In a duty to defend case, the determination of the duty to defend arises from the underlying petition. In this case, this petition tells you that the property damage became apparent in the spring of 1986. The Dorchester case tells you that once you determine what the occurrence is, which is the first part of the test, which is a cause analysis, you then look to determine when that property damage became apparent, because that is the policy that becomes triggered by the occurrence. In this particular petition, it's made clear that the property damage became apparent in the spring of 1986. All of the damage allegations against Cullen Frost that are alleged in here, alleged to have been discovered in the spring of 1986 inspection. Any subsequent loss of use or subsequent property damage under these pleadings are simply a continuation of the same property damage that was discovered in the spring of 1986.
Okay, you're in follow-up to Justice Cornyn's question. In the Dorchester analysis, the Commonwealth policy that was February of 86, or maybe the one that was up to February of 86, would be the insurance policy to be looked to for coverage if there was going to be coverage.
Correct.
And now, then the next question then is, how come Dorchester doesn't also say that the occurrence they're alleging, faulty workmanship that led to this continual damage by rain and weathering and that sort of thing, why isn't that sufficient to invoke the duty to defend?
Because there's two reasons. One is that under the cause analysis, which comes from the definition of the occurrence, You must determine what was the accident that resulted in the property damage. And then, once you've determined what that accident is, it's a question of which policy is triggered by that accident. Under Dorchester, which is the manifestation rule that's followed in all but one state, the policy that is triggered is the policy during which this damage becomes apparent. But the cause analysis cases and the manifestation cases also say that once it becomes apparent, that is the policy that is triggered by the occurrence or by the accident.
I'm now asking you, I mean, that just simply says that one of those Commonwealth policies in 86 are the ones that would be the relevant policy. I'm asking you, what is it about this occurrence under the state of the pleadings that doesn't say Commonwealth has a duty to defend?
Because the pleadings do not say that different unrelated property damage was discovered subsequent to the spring of 1986. The only damage that is alleged is damage that was discovered in the spring of 1986. Under the way the occurrence is defined, which requires the cause to be determined, what was the accident? And under the manifestation rule, the singular occurrence under these allegations became apparent in spring of 1986. Under the manifestation rule, then, that is the policy that's triggered. Now, under this chart, because spring of 1986 could arguably fall under the first policy or the second policy, those two policies potentially may apply. But because this occurrence is manifested itself in the spring of 86, the subsequent policies are not triggered, because the occurrence has already happened. The occurrence has already been triggered in the earlier policy. This analysis of the insurance policy is also consistent with what is known as the loss of progress rule. That is, you can't insure a loss which has already manifested itself. Insurance is designed to insure against risk, not certainty. The loss in progress cases determined that once the risk has manifested itself in property damage, then subsequent policies aren't triggered because the risk is no longer a risk, it's a certainty. Here, the first question the court has to determine is, what was the occurrence, what was the accident that resulted in the property? Under these allegations, what resulted in the property damage was defective construction of the condominium units. Cullen Frost's involvement in that defective construction was the allegation that they didn't properly monitor the funds that were used in the construction process in their duties as a construction lender. That all occurred, obviously, before the damages in the units were discovered. The cases tell you that if there is one cause of this property damage, then there is one occurrence, because you have to look at what was the accident that resulted in the property damage. If there was one accident that resulted in the property damage, then there was one occurrence. Then the second step of the two-step analysis is determining when that occurrence for purposes of insurance policy takes place. Under Dorchester, which follows the manifestation rule that nearly all states follow, that occurrence is triggered when the property damage becomes apparent. At that point in time, that is the policy that applies. The subsequent policies are not triggered because the occurrence has already taken place. There's not an occurrence during their policy period because the occurrence was triggered before those policies ever came into effect.
Hey, Mr. Cook, going back to my questions, let's assume that the U.S. fire policies are not involved in this. I'm still asking, is there any question in your mind that at least two of those policies are implicated in the allegations in the plaintiff's pleadings? The policy that went up to February of 86 and the policy that began in February of 86.
Under Judge B, we have not argued in the Court of Appeals or here that there was not an occurrence in the spring of 1986. Therefore, I would agree with your question that those two, first two policies are potentially implicated under the posture of the case by the concrete plaintiff's petition, but only those two policies.
Okay. Under Dorchester, as to those two cases, have they not alleged an occurrence? I'm a little vague on the facts in Dorchester, but it seemed to me Dorchester had to do a builder, build some property, and they called it a construction defect, and Dorchester was assessing what insurance company was going to be responsible for this, and you get this discussion about occurrence. Why isn't that the Dorchester facts for those first two policies, assuming we figure out when in the spring of 86 the manifestation occurred? Why would not those two policies be covered under the pleadings that the plaintiff made?
One of the amicus parties has argued that there was no occurrence fault. However, for the posture of this case in the Court of Appeals and here, the petitioners have not taken the position that there was not an occurrence that was triggered during one of those first two policies. The law that the Court of Appeals made and the law that must be corrected by this court is that the subsequent three policies potentially apply to this loss because the petition alleged an occurrence during the subsequent three policy periods.
Assuming that we address those last three policies, didn't Commonwealth refuse the duty to defend under its first two policies?
Yes, it did.
So it's entirely possible that we could agree with you as the last three policies and Commonwealth still lose under Dorchester, still having had a duty to defend in the state of these pleadings because of those first two policies.
Well, all that is at issue at this point in time is the applicability of these two policies, as well as some of the exclusions which were raised at the time summary judgment was granted. Cullen Frost.
In that connection, let me follow up just a Phoenix question with regards to the a matter that concerns me. Assuming there's coverage under the first two policies, are you waiving your argument about the alienated property exclusion?
Not at all, Your Honor.
Would you address that?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Pick up Justice Phoenix's question on alienated property exclusion.
Of course, the court's letter to us didn't indicate that that point was granted, and that's why I've not stood here and argued about the alienated property
exclusion.
But I do believe that the Court of Appeals erred in not applying the alienated property exclusion. And the reason is very simple. What the Cullen Frost, the Tompkins plaintiffs are suing for is damages to what they purchased from Cullen Frost. They're suing for damages to their condominium units, and there are allegations that some of the damage was to common areas. However, all they're entitled to recover under the law is damage to what they purchased, the condominium units, and only their proportional interest in the common areas. But they can't recover damages what Cullen Frost still owns. They can only recover damages to what they purchased. Certainly, we believe that the alienated property exclusion and the completed operations exclusion apply in the first two policies. And we are not and have never waived that point or argued that doesn't apply. And in addition, all the occurrence analysis indicates is that those first two policies may apply. There may be other exclusions which may present a reason why there is no coverage under those two policies. We believe that the Court of Appeals opinion sets a bad precedent and needs to be corrected by this court. I think that the response from the amicus parties indicate that
the insurance industry is concerned about the result reached by the Court of Appeals and its public policy implications. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May I please report Mr. Jerry Ferguson to the argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. It's my pleasure today to represent Cullen Frost Bank, who for purposes of this argument will be referred to as Cullen Frost or the insurer. The first point I care to make to the court is about the current posture of this case. They have admitted in their brief that there was an occurrence that took place, at least when the plaintiff's inspection, what we've got denominated as the plaintiff's inspection, took place in the spring of 1986. Once they have admitted that an occurrence takes place, the only way that they can avoid a duty to defend is to prove to this court or establish in this court that their duty to defend was in some way abrogated under one of their policy exclusions. At the trial court, they argued for what is now essentially two exclusions. The first is alienated property, and the second is completed operations.
If I can just... Yes, sir. Ask a question that helped clarify something for me. All we're talking about is a duty to defend here. You're not arguing that even if there was a duty to defend under multiple policies that you're entitled to stack
No.
those policy limits for purposes of...
I am not, and I want to make that clear that is not our intention here today. Our intention is strictly whether or not there was a duty to defend this case. On their part. As a matter of fact, I think it's pretty clear under some of their policies that you cannot stack to get to multiple limits. And I'll go into that in a minute. But my point on it is that once they've admitted an occurrence, the only way that they can get out of the duty to defend is to establish an exclusion under their policies. The Court of Appeals held that issue on both the alienation clause and the completed operations adverse to the insurance companies in this place. This court has not granted writ on the issue of the alienation of property or the completed operations for the policy that was in force in effect for the spring of 1986 to me. So as far as the result of the case, it seems to me that procedurally, regardless of what the court's analysis on the timing of the occurrence, that given the fact that the court denied the writ as to the exclusions that were applicable in the spring of 1986, that it would appear to me that the case should be decided in favor of the insured, given their concession of the occurrence.
Don't we have to go beyond that, don't we have to look at what is the nature of that occurrence, when did it occur?
They admitted the occurrence. In their brief, they admit that the occurrence took place in the spring of 1986. And once they have made that admission that there is an occurrence, their duty to defend is triggered, absent an exclusion.
Then you have to deal with it, assuming that there is coverage of at least those first two policies, you have to deal with the exclusion.
Certainly, my point is that this court did not grant writ on those exclusions for those two policies.
I understand that, but you do understand also that the whole case is before us, and those exclusions are...
Certainly, for the subsequent policies, and I'll address those.
The whole ball of wax is before us. Even the court can, if it chooses, deal with the exclusions as to any of the five policies.
I understand that, and I wanted to bring up to the court as to what the court's order was on the granting of on the writ of error specifically. As I read it, it wasn't applicable for these time periods. Some basic law on the duty to defend is basically this. Because you have to determine it from the policies out there, that the insureds are entitled to a very liberal construction of the underlying petition as to whether or not there is a duty to defend. We don't have to. That petition does not have to be squarely within the terms and conditions of their insurance policy. All that we have to show is that there is a possibility, and underline the word possibility, that there may be a duty brought about under their policy to indemnify at least one of the causes of action pled. The Second Amendment petition, which is the one that is before this court, is clear. It's ambiguous in some degrees, but nevertheless, those ambiguities are required to be resolved in favor of the insurer. There is what we consider to be a typographical error in there. If you'll read the complaint as a whole, at one point it says the plaintiff said the inspection made in 86. Then it says the defendants had it made. A subsequent pleading that is before the court, which is the Third Amendment one, corrected that typographical error and made it clear that they were talking about a plaintiff's inspection that was done.
You're not contending for purposes of the duty to defend we should look to the Third Amendment petition, are you?
I have raised as one of my cross points on it, basically, that I felt that the trial court error, in not granting a motion for new trial based on the Third Amendment petition on the basis of the Second Amendment petition had been superseded.
But for purposes of determining the propriety of the summary judgment in this case, we can only look at the Second Amendment petition. Wouldn't you agree?
I think that the law is generally that in very limited circumstances do you look outside of the existing police. So there are some cases that indicate that you can do that in a limited number of circumstances, but there aren't any of them. In the Court of Appeals, and in this court too, they sponsored an analysis, and I say they, I mean the insurers, sponsored an analysis based on the Dorchester case. The Dorchester case essentially held that when you're looking at the time of occurrence, that you look at when the property damage is actually occurring. In this case, you have an allegation that there was continuing property damage that occurred out there, including the loss of the use of property that happened. The loss of the use of property necessarily occurs over a period of time. Under the analysis that they want to have this court adopt is essentially once there is the first indication of damage, that is an occurrence, and that can be the only occurrence. Now, I personally believe that flies in the teeth, not only of the existing case law, but also of their own policies. Their own policies specify that an occurrence happens when there is, quote, loss of use of property. And it doesn't say the first time that loss is discovered. It doesn't say the second time that loss is discovered. It says when there is a loss of use of property that an occurrence has occurred.
Under your theory, yes. That loss of use would continue into the policy periods of written by U.S. Fire, correct?
Yes, and I don't...
And can you tell me what, why we should permit a person who realizes that a loss is in progress that they might ultimately get sued for to buy liability insurance which would cover the loss that's already in progress? Isn't there some potential for bad things to happen?
Certainly there is. And if you look at that loss in progress rule, the courts that really analyze that rule are dealing with essentially a circumstance of inter-insurer liability. That is how they're going to allocate it between the insurance companies as a matter of common law. But more importantly, the loss in progress rule is really an offshoot of some sort of fraudulent misrepresentation or concealment claim, or when you knew that what you were doing was going to cause damage to someone else. Okay, so it's kind of a variant of the intentional infliction of the loss type of analysis. And all of the cases that deal with that basically say that you have to know with certainty that there is going to be a loss in the future before they'll exclude it.
But isn't there some tension between the loss in progress rule and your theory that the damages are continuing through all five of these policies?
Well, I think there is some tension between them, but I think it's primarily, if you will look at the cases that deal with that loss in progress rule, what they are really going back to is some sort of fraudulent concealment theory, that the insured knew about this and didn't tell his insurance company and they underwrote it anyway. It would be a very simple matter for them to exclude any loss in progress under their policy, and they didn't do it. So my answer to your question is, under their policies, the way they wrote them is, yes, they're on the hook for that. They knew about it on September 23rd, 1987, when we made a demand on them for the defense. They continued to write policies without any exclusions in them.
Even after you've already been sued for it?
They continued to write these policies after we had been sued without an exclusion in there.
And did you tell them that you'd been sued?
Sure, we made a demand on them to defend the case on it, and they continued to write them after that time.
You made a demand on U.S. Fire before?
Well, excuse me, we made a demand on Commonwealth.
Right, let's focus on U.S. Fire.
Sure.
What public policy reason is there to, piggybacking on Justice Corner's question, to what public policy concerns are advanced by placing on U.S. Fire a duty to defend for an occurrence that occurred and you knew of, you know, in the spring of 86, you know, 2 years or before they issued the policy?
What duty is there?
No. What public policy considerations are banned by placing on U.S. Fire a duty to defend for losses that occurred 2 years before the policy was issued?
The public policy consideration is basically that that's how they wrote the contract. They didn't exclude a loss in progress. These are sister companies handled by the same claims adjusters and whatnot. And they knew about it in September, at least when we got served with the lawsuit. On or about that time. Now, my point on it is that there's nothing, if you stop and look at it in public policy, that says that you cannot go back and retro-insure a loss that's happened. Okay, so it's done in sophisticated markets, and I will grant you that it's not under normally a commercial general liability policy or comprehensive general liability policy. When major companies have catastrophic losses, a lot of times they would go back and retro-insure those if they were not insured.
I think somebody mentioned in the brief that this is the same as insuring a dead person.
Pardon me?
This is analogous to insuring a dead person.
With this question, well, under the example that I was talking about, or under the example I was talking about, for instance, a lot of these insurance companies would undertake a risk where the accident's already happened on the basis that they can settle the risk cheaper than the insured could. On it now. So from that purpose, unless you intend to eliminate that as a class of coverage, I would strongly urge the court not to accept that as a public policy argument, that basically that you can never retro insure a loss on it. And my point on it is that from my standpoint is they knew about it, they continued to insure it, they could have excluded it had they wanted to. They didn't choose to do that. If you look at the cases, the Fifth Circuit, the U.S. Fifth Circuit, in a case that involved a silicosis case, I believe, that was applying Texas law to these policies, and it basically said that the duty to defend under a silicosis case triggered all of the policies during the period that the man was exposed to it, because it was a continuing loss case. All the silicosis cases.
Triggered all the policies for the policy limits or for a duty to defend?
No, this is just for the duty to defend. Because what's
practically at stake in this case under the points bearer we granted on?
I'm sorry, I missed the question.
If you're not trying to stack these policies,
yes,
limits, what is the practical effect of which of you wins this case?
Well, the practical effect is we were denied it under the two Commonwealth policies at the trial.
Well, assuming that
there's nothing practical at stake.
Okay. Okay.
Well, I mean, from a practical standpoint,
if they lose on their defenses to the whole coverage.
Sure.
The completed operations and the alienation.
Sure.
From a practical effect, as a practical matter, the result's the same either way.
Absolutely.
Okay. Counsel, let me suggest to you, though, that if there is a judgment rendered in the case, which straddles more than one policy period, isn't there going to be some question ultimately that will arise as to the contribution rights as between the different insurers?
Sure, and that's a whole separate issue, though, from and those are dealt with. A number of the cases that they cite to you for purposes, and that was a distinction that we very strenuously argued in our brief, for this purpose of determining when there was an occurrence on when they first occurred. There's a number of cases that say that between the insurance companies, it's a matter of law. You basically, you hold that it's the guy that's on the risk at the time, the very first manifestation of any type of property damage, that he gets hit first between the insurance companies.
Well, just to follow up on the Chief Justice's question, while there's diminishing utility in having multiple duties to defend invoked,
sure,
there are practical consequences once this case proceeds to judgment, and the insurance companies, if there is a duty to defend under multiple policies, there are practical consequences as between the insurers in deciding who pays how much of the judgment. Wouldn't you agree with that?
I think that would be clear that if they didn't have a duty to defend the case, they probably would not be obligated.
But if there is a duty to defend under multiple policies, you would have that very real, practical.
You would have to probably deal with that issue then. But again, I'm going to say that the law that appears to be that exists between insurance companies is substantially different than the law that exists between the insurance company and the insured when the insured is merely seeking a defense in the case. The cases that they cite for this concept of first manifestation is the policy that's on the hook. All of those cases distinguish themselves from dealing with an insured scenario. And the stacking of the multiple policy limits, actually, they have a clause in their policy, and it's called their unifying clause. And what their unifying clause says is that for purposes of the determination of the limits of liability of these policies, and underline the words, for the purposes of the limits of liability of these policies, that it's basically that anything coming out of these same set of facts will deem to be one risk. In other words, so you can't stack them on top of each other, and that stops the stacking. In effect, the fact that they have such a clause in their policy necessarily means that the insurance companies have acknowledged that there is a risk that where you get a continuing loss type of case, such as this, that multiple policies can be swung.
Well, does that mean where there's a deductible, that the insured has to incur multiple deductibles too?
If
Frost Bank, Cullen Frost here had a $50,000 deductible under each of these five policies, would the insurers be entitled to invoke those deductibles against the insured before their policies would be?
For which ones? For purposes of defense or for purposes of indemnity?
Well, I presume for purposes of indemnity.
For purposes of indemnity, it's clear that there's one policy limit that's out there. So I was being consistent with that. I would say that there would be one deductible if you were entitled to one policy limit.
And that's consistent with there being a single occurrence.
It is consistent with their unifying clause in their policy that does not allow you to stack those policies for purposes of determining policy limits. I'm going to move quickly to the alienation of property and the completed operations. If you read what they're complaining of in the petition, they've got allegations in there that we didn't take care of the common area that we were supposed to, that these damages were occurring to the common area. That we had one condominium unit price to sell below what we sold one of them to. All of that in the petition establishes the fact that, and it's undisputed, that all periods of time, Cullen Frost owns at least one of the units that comprise the Holland condominiums and a corresponding percentage of the common area that's out there. All of the policies, all of them, February of 1983 to November of 89, show the Holland condominiums to be the insured premises on the face of the policy. Their argument that somehow that this deals with alienated property ignores the fact that the complaints that the Tompkins plaintiffs are complaining of deal primarily with the common area. They're griping about the hallways, they're griping about the roofs, they don't like the elevators, they don't like the plumbing in the whole building. All of that pertains to the common areas of which Cullen Frost continued to own during it. And as I said, the fact that we owned it is undisputed. Therefore, I see very limited application in their alienation clause in their property.
So you're saying that anybody who has a condominium complex of any size, 100 units, 200 units, the way to extend coverage is to keep one of them.
If you sell
199 units and keep one, and that extends the policy as long as you own that one unit, even though you sold 199.
If the complaints are to the common area, which is such they are, yes. And you're charged with some responsibility for upkeeping that common area, and you've shown it as the insured premises, and they've charged a premium on the basis of the insured premises, that's the insured premises, then yes, I would agree that they're still on the hook.
There are no complaints as to individual units themselves.
Were there some complaints? You could read it that there were some complaints to individual units, but it's clear that the majority of the complaints that they're complaining about are to the common areas. And the law is pretty clear that if the insurance company is required to defend any portion of a petition, they're required to defend all of it. That's there. On it. The completed operations, the products, hazards, and the completed operations were two exclusions that they raised in their motion for summary judgment. The products hazard, they have conceded, has no applicability to the current issue. The completed operations, it's kind of the flip side of product hazards. Those are typically designed to get at what I would consider classic products liability type of situations. In order to come under the completed operations clauses, you know, I apologize for the print, we couldn't get it much bigger than this and get it on the plane coming down. I'm going to step over here. In order to become completed operations, the very first initial inquiry to being a completed operation is that the operations have to be completed, and two, they have to occur away from premises owned by or rented by the insurer. Sure, as I said, it is undisputed in this case that at all times material, we owned the Holland condominiums, or part of the Holland condominiums in this case. They were shown as the insured premises. So it fails on the standpoint that it occurred, quote, away from the insured premises. Secondly, the complaints that they're making are because we didn't complete the duties that we said we were supposed to do. They said we failed to repair them on the Tompkins pleadings. There's no allegation here that we, in fact, completed those and that we're being sued for defective completion of those duties. Under the literal reading of completed operations, therefore, they don't fall within the first two-pronged test of it. Secondly, I don't really have time to go down, but if you look at the second three, they don't fall under any of those either of being completed. And I would go back and state to the court that, again, the Court of Appeals, we believe, properly determined the case clearly on the alienation of property and on the completed operations coverage. There aren't a lot of cases dealing with completed operations. One of the Dallas Court of Appeals cases that dealt with it, I believe it's the HRK case, basically says that, let me step over here again, that it's designated primarily for a business that performs services or maintenance such as contractors or subcontractors.
fact that these people go onto a premise and they leave it, their work is performed, they don't have ongoing responsibility such as existed in this case. So my point to...
What would be an example of that?
A completed operation. Let's take an example dealing with the construction business. You hire a man to come and build a garage for you out at your house. He comes and puts up his garage. He's finished with his work. He leaves it. The garage collapses 10 years later. That's a completed operation. It's not a case where the man's out there and he's working on it, and while he's continuing, or say it doesn't cover the case, for instance, if you decide to go out and build a garage, and you're building your garage, and as you're building that garage, you short-circuit it, and it burns down by somebody's house or something. As I said, it's kind of that, and the products hazards exclusion are really what's designed to get at. It's kind of a classical, nearly products liability type of situation that exists.
Any other questions?
My red light's on, so if there are any other questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you very much.
In response to Chief Justice Phillips' question, there's a very real practical effect. Even if the court decides the exclusions don't apply, the FNA property completed operation. The very first real practical effect is U.S. Fire, which didn't come onto the scene until after the property damage was discovered and after the lawsuit was filed, has been held by the Court of Appeals to have a policy which potentially applies.
Well, you knew of the hazard, and you still insured it without specific... You knew of the hazard, and you still insured it without specific excluding loss of progress. That's their argument. How do you...
Well, Your Honor, we disagree because we believe that the way that the policy defines occurrence prevents that result. But second, what the notice, which they claim they were put on notice, I don't believe is in the record. And if you look at the pleadings of the insurers, they have a notice defense in the case. Additionally, the Court of Appeals did not say, and this court, under the posture of the case, cannot say there is a duty to defend under those two policies. And the reason is that the insurers moved for summary judgment saying that there was no duty to defend for a variety of reasons. The cross motion, there was no cross motion for summary judgment denied at that time, nor was there a point of error in the Court of Appeals that the court erred in denying any motion for summary judgment they had on file. If this case is sent back to the trial court, essentially the parties start over with regard to matters that have not already been decided. For instance, the notice offense, which still needs to be pursued. Additionally, there is very practical consequences with regard to potential bad faith claims, with regard to the number of policies that apply, with regard to whether U.S. Fire even ought to be considered.
There is no conflict between U.S. Fire and Commonwealth in this case.
They are owned by the same company, or they are sister companies, but yet they are separate parties.
But they have the same lawyers, trial as well as on appeal.
That's correct.
Are you asking us to treat this case as if there were five separate policies issued by five separate companies?
I think that under the analysis of which policy applies, you do that. It doesn't matter that, and in fact, one of the Cardi cases we cited to the court indicates that it doesn't matter if all five of these policies were issued by the same company. You still have the issue of which policy applies. And in this case, that's important for other reasons, which is the third policy, the one in the middle, did not exclude completed operations. Therefore, they argue, and we don't agree, that if there was a continuing occurrence, there would be a duty to defend under that policy, even if this was considered a completed operation, because that policy for a period of time didn't exclude it.
In the lower courts, you took the position that the claims
you were being asked to defend were not property damage within the meaning of the policy, but you do not take that position here. Is that correct?
That's correct. Now, with regard to the NNA property exclusion, I believe that counsel was wrong. The court did not deny the writ on those issues. It simply did not grant them. And as the court knows, the entire case is before the court, and the court can choose to address the NNA property and complete operation exclusion. And I urge the court to do that. The case law says, and we cited to the court below, a case involving condominium units, indicating that the sale of condominium units is NNA property. They're suing for damage to property they bought from the insurer. The Court of Appeals said that
how about the co-tenancy theory and owning of the common area? Do they still own one unit, or they still...
Judge, we believe that under the...
And that the insured property was not unit, but the complex.
Judge, first, with regard to the insured unit being the complex, we're talking about the applicability of the exclusion. Okay? So whether or not the insured unit is insured property doesn't mean it's covered if there's another, if there's an exclusion in the property that excludes property damage to alienated property. But to answer your question on co-tenancy, what the trial court below awards the Tompkins plaintiffs is money. They don't award them repair of the common areas, they give them money. And what do they give them money for? They give them money for what they purchase. Their proportionate interest in the common area. The property that they bought from Cullen Cross, and that is alienated property. They're suing for damage to what they bought. They can't get damage for what somebody else owns. They can't get money for that. In response to another question or comment by counsel, the loss in progress rule, if it were limited to disputes between insurers, would not answer the policy issue raised by Justice Cornyn, which is if an insurer can go out and insure a loss that's already happened, then that implicates bad public policy. On the other hand, it is good public policy to embrace the loss in progress rule and cause analysis. It protects the insurer's access to insurance because it holds its premiums down. Premiums are gauged on that there's a risk of damage that may occur, not a certainty. If you allow an insurer to insure a risk that's already occurred, then premiums are going to go up. It's going to make it more difficult for insurers to have access to insurance.
What is your argument to Mr. Ferguson's your response to Mr. Ferguson's argument with regards to the other exclusion, the completed operations exclusion?
Your Honor, we believe that the completed operations exclusion applies because the only argument they come up with is the same common area argument, which is that because Cullen Cross retained an interest in the common area, that the completed operations exclusion doesn't apply. That's the same analysis with the alienated property exclusion. They can't recover damages for what Cullen Cross still owns. They can only recover damages for what they purchased. Looking from Cullen Cross' point of view, that is a completed operation. Their sale of the condominium unit to the purchaser is complete.
Would you comment on the response counsel gave to the question about impact on the insured in terms of the deductibles that might apply if we adopt a multiple occurrence?
Well, Judge, certainly there are cases in which if the insured argues that there are a number of occurrences, in fact, that could work against the insured because if the policy has a deductible per occurrence, then arguing that there are multiple occurrences would involve multiple deductibles. And in fact, that could harm the insured rather than assist the insured. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument. dismiss cause and concludes the court's submission docket. The foregoing cause is submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will please adjourn the court. Thank you.